Hi, listening friend. It's Monday. It's May 27th. It's Memorial Day. And so I have a special two-day broadcast that I hope will honor our veterans and the many families that have lost loved ones that have served our country so faithfully. Today in tomorrow's edition of Mark and Friends, you're going to hear the broadcast that the Public Square put together last year as they interviewed Laura Hildenbrand, author of the book Unbroken. I was so moved and impressed after listening to the account of what Louis Zamperini went through during his time serving in World War II and sensing the importance that we do not forget, I'm going to air Dave Zanotti's interview with Laura Hildenbrand over the next few days, and you also hear from Wayne Shepherd. So on this Memorial Day, we salute all of you in our services, and may we never forget the sacrificial gift you've given all of us, the freedoms you've protected, and fighting so faithfully for our liberty. We say thank you on this Memorial Day. Here's Wayne Shepherd, Dave Zanotti, and then Dave will introduce Laura Hildenbrand, as recorded last July on the program The Public Square, which we air at 11 a.m. on WGNJ on Saturdays.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to today's edition, I think a very special edition of The Public Square. I'm Wayne Shepherd here with Dave Zanotti of the American Policy Roundtable. And Dave, we like to shake things up once in a while, don't we?
Wayne, you know the old saying, it's better to give than receive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we see it a lot, especially around Christmas time, on lots and lots of greeting cards. Some people don't know that that was actually a direct quotation of Jesus, and it was something that St. Paul talked about in the book of Acts to the Ephesian elders, quoting Jesus, saying it's more blessed to give than receive. Well, today's broadcast is a gift to America.
Can I admit that I'm a little jealous that you got to do this interview? Is that okay to admit?
Can I admit that I'm really, really glad I got to?
You are going to spend the rest of this program today interviewing an author. Her name is Laura Hildenbrand, and you may recognize that name, you may not, but she's the author of a very best-selling book called Seabiscuit, which was a very popular movie. But it's not about Seabiscuit that we want to focus on today. It's her book, Unbroken, the story of Louis Zamperini. Now, a friend of mine gifted this book to me a few months ago, and I read it, and I told you, Dave, you got to get this book, and you did. So thank you for reading that.
I will tell you, it's what I call a three-cry book. I had to set it down three times and cry. It was that powerful.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Louis Zamperini, and you'll go into the detail here somewhat with the author in just a moment as we turn to your pre-recorded interview, but Louis Zamperini ran in the 36 Olympics. He actually shook Adolf Hitler's hand in the 36 Olympics, and then the story that follows is just amazing. World War II, Japanese POW, stranded before that in a life raft. I mean, you got to read the details of this book to really understand, but what made you want to talk to the author?
Well, because this is a true story. Because God permitted Laura Hildenbrand to meet Louis Zamperini in a very unusual way. Louis is still, at the time of this broadcasting, he's still alive and with us today. His story has been largely forgotten to the nation. It is a remarkable story. It's just such a powerful story, and it depicts the story of an entire generation, a generation that is pretty much now walking off the scene of this life. And I think it's really important for us to remember.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't we turn to the interview? It's very compelling because I want to save time at the end to talk to you once you've wrapped up with the author that you're going to speak with today. And I want to get some of your personal reaction to talking to this woman and hearing more of Louis Zamperini's story. So why don't we turn to the interview now? Dave Zanotti here on the Public Square with his guest.
Well, let's start with you and your history. People now know you as a famous and very successful and compelling author. But what were you doing before you became a successful, compelling author?
I was writing magazine articles. I've written for a lot of different places, writing actually mostly on equine veterinary medicine for a magazine called Equus. And I did also a lot of articles on horse racing and some general history articles as well.
And that's what brought you forward into the story of Seabiscuit, right?
Yes, yes.
Let's just take a second to talk about that because, wow, what a blockbuster film. What a great book. Did you see it coming? Did you know you had the winning ticket with that story?
I felt as I was researching it like this was an unbelievably great story. I can't say that I thought it was going to be a bestseller or a big hit. I mean, I think that was kind of an unrealistic thought for someone as obscure as I was. And certainly nobody encouraged me to think that was going to happen. But it happened right away. It was just, it was an amazing, just a stunning experience for me. And it made me so happy. I didn't, with either book, attach myself to how it would do commercially. This was something I made a point of doing. I wanted to write the best book I could write and let it go because I was out of control of everything else. So I was completely happy and satisfied when I was done. And the rest of it just wasn't up to me. And it was just a happy surprise when it worked out.
How delightful. And what a great story. And it's been an inspiration to so many people. Then comes the second book, which is of course, they're bestsellers, and people are now becoming familiar with Unbroken. But at the time that you and I are doing this interview, my personal conviction is that people have yet to discover this book. It's already a bestseller. It's already all over the place. I think this book has miles and miles to go. Because I've got to tell you, I have a profound prejudice. Laura, it's one of the best books I've ever read.
Wow. Thank you so much. That's a huge compliment. Thank you.
I've read so many books that I had to read, and a few I can actually remember, or that I put them down and I cried. And I've got to tell you, you got me. There was a point in this book that I put it down and I just cried. Such a compelling story. Let's jump into it. When did you first find out about this Italian kid, Louis Zamperini?
It was actually Seabiscuit that led me to him. It was back in around 1998 while I was researching Seabiscuit to write the book on him. I was looking at an original 1938 newspaper clipping on Seabiscuit, and I happened to turn it over. And on the other side was a story about this Southern California running phenomenon named Louis Zamperini. And the article was written prior to the war and his incredible experiences in the war. But he already had a really interesting story. He'd been this rebel kid, this ruffian, who turned his life around and become an overnight Olympian and a huge star, and at that time was thought was probably going to be the first four-minute miler. And that intrigued me. I read the article. I wrote down his name. A little later, I learned the basics of his war story. And when I finished Seabiscuit, I started looking for him, and I tracked him down in Southern California. He was still around, and I sent him a letter, and he wrote me back, and I called him, and he told me his whole story about the war. And I was completely hooked. I knew this was my next book.
Now, he told you the whole story over the phone?
Yeah. I mean, we probably talked for an hour and a half.
Okay. So
he didn't tell me every detail because his story is a long story and an amazing story. But he told me enough. And I was just completely blown away by it.
What happened to Louis' story? Was it never told, or had it been told and forgotten by a generation?
When Louis came back from the war, he was a big celebrity all over America. I actually have the love letters he wrote to his girlfriend in 1946, and in one of them he says he'd already received 1,000 letters from strangers. So he was a big star. His story really captivated people, but that was kind of lost. People forgot about it. And Louis wrote an autobiography with another writer who actually did the writing. And other than that, the story had kind of faded away. And I had never heard of him. And most of the people I've spoken to said they had never heard of him before they read my book. So it was sort of similar to Seabiscuit. People had forgotten all about Seabiscuit. And Seabiscuit was the number one newsmaker in America in 1938. But by the time I wrote about him, nobody even knew the name anymore.
Well, that's a whole other radio broadcast, isn't it, about how in culture we forget.
Yeah, we do.
And which is one of the great reasons why people write books, and again, why we're so thankful for what you've done. Let's go back to Louis for a second. So you had this phone conversation with him for an hour and a half, and then I would guess that you flew out to California and had a whole series of meetings with him.
I didn't fly out to California. I'm disabled, and I can't fly. I have a chronic illness, and I actually haven't been on a plane since 1990. so I ended up spending 7 years on this book, and I didn't meet Louis in person in that entire time. We did everything over the telephone. We would have these epic 3-hour interviews, and we would do them 3 or 4 times a week. And I did this over 7 years, and I got to know this guy better than I know myself. And he became very dear to me. We did eventually meet. We met a few months ago after the book came out, and it was absolutely wonderful. It was everything I'd hoped for and everything he'd hoped for. But the interesting thing was I never met my subject in person until long after the book came out.
Laura, that's an amazing hidden fact about this book, because as you describe this man, I feel like you're his sister, that you grew up with him. you were there with him during his pre-flight training, that you were there as he was running in the Olympics, that you were there when the plane got shot down. So as you got into the story, how did you know where to start? Did you say, okay, this has got to be birth to today? How did you pick, because there's so much in. I mean, this guy's lived 3 or 4 lives, and they're all noteworthy.
Yeah, and they're all his life definitely has different acts to it, because he was the rogue kid who became the running superstar, the world famous runner, who became the soldier, who became the castaway on a raft, who became a prisoner of war, and then had this religious experience at the end of his life, and so there's so much to talk about with him. And what I did, I mean, I wrote the story in a chronological manner, but I wanted to pull something out to use as a preface that would capture something about who he was, and get people to see what they were heading toward as they began reading about his life. And so what I pulled out was this moment when he was a castaway on a raft after his plane crashed, and he was starving to death. There are 2 other men on the raft, and a plane flies over, and they think it's an American plane, and they start waving, thinking they're going to be rescued, and the men on the plane start shooting at them, and it turned out it was a Japanese bomber. And Louis dove overboard, and there are sharks in the water, and the sharks start attacking him, and that was the moment I began the book with.
All he could see in every direction was water.
Yes.
It was late June 1943, somewhere on the endless expanse of the Pacific Ocean, Army Air Forces bombardier and Olympic runner Louis Zamperini lay across a small raft drifting westward. Man, you had me at hello on that one.
For 47 days, all he could see was water. In millions and millions and millions of square miles of the Pacific, he was out there on a tiny little raft, starving to death.
With 3 other guys, one of whom perished,
yes.
there at sea. Wow, there are so many subplots and aspects of this story that are going to stick with you for a lifetime thinking about. I want to get into one of the particulars that you brought up about when they were on the raft. You mentioned it twice, about how they sang on the raft and that they sang Christmas music.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that they were very worried about when they ended up on that raft was that they would lose their minds, which was a very, very common consequence and happened quite quickly to men who became castaways. And your odds of surviving once you ended up out on a raft during World War II, if you were shot down or you crashed and you ended up on a raft, your odds of surviving were terrible. They were really terrible. And one of the reasons was that people tended to go mad. So these guys, Louis especially, they wanted to focus on keeping their wits about them. And they did everything they could, telling each other stories, asking each other questions, constantly keeping their minds working. And one of the things that Louis did was teach the other two the words to the song White Christmas, Bing Crosby's song, which was at that time, that year anyway, was a big hit. It was a new song. And so they were out there in June and July on the Pacific singing to an audience of sharks, White Christmas. And I love that little detail. I thought that was wonderful.
I don't think I'll ever consider that song the same way again.
I don't think I will either. Yeah, it was so meaningful to them. All those little things that kept them sane, and it did keep them sane. They floated for 47 days, and they never lost their wits. And a lot of men would go insane in 3 or 4 days. And they lost half their body weight. They went through horrible things. They were attacked by sharks. They were attacked by a plane. But they never lost their wits.
Well, we're just getting started with today's very special conversation with Dave and his guest. And we'll be back in just a moment with more. You'll find us online at APRoundtable.org.
Be merry and bright. And may all your Christmases be white.
We will be right back for more on the Public Square.
In case you just tuned in, this is the Monday edition of Mark and Friends. And on this Memorial Day, we're remembering our veterans, those that have faithfully served our country. And I was so impressed with this interview that I heard on Saturday. I broke it into two parts. Part one and part two will air tomorrow. And I'm sure many of you are going to go out and buy the book Unbroken. But let us not forget the incredible sacrificial gift of their energy, time, efforts, their resources, just the various ways that our armed services have sacrificially given for this country, for you and I, to enjoy our liberties. Back to the interview with Dave Zanotti and Laura Hildenbrand.
They drifted, was it 2,000 miles?
2,000 miles, yeah.
And eventually, well, of course, we think that the book is heading toward a wonderful ending as the planes from the United States, the Allied forces, come in and rescue these men off this raft, but not exactly.
No. It turned out to be a Japanese bomber with some very, very sadistic men on board. I mean, they, from their perspective, they're looking down on three emaciated men on a raft who are not armed. I mean, at the very least, if you're the enemy, you keep going. But instead, they made many passes over them, machine gunning the raft. And Louis went overboard 6 or 7 times, sort of hiding under the raft to try to escape the bullets. The other two men were too weak to go overboard other than the first time. And the sharks began attacking him while he was under the raft, and he was having to kind of whack them in the nose or kick at them to keep them away. And he was not bitten, but he had to go through this, I believe, 6 times.
Well, the story, the plot gets thicker because they are rescued, so to speak, but they're actually captured then by the Japanese.
Yes, they were. And that they knew that was very, very bad news. The Japanese had already earned an absolutely terrible reputation for the way they treated prisoners of war. They had murdered 90,000 prisoners of war in China all at once in the rape of Nanjing. And they did it under orders. It was done deliberately. The Japanese, you never in the history of mankind, the last place you want to end up as a POW was in the hands of the Japanese in World War II. And so they knew they were in trouble when they were captured.
Laura, have we forgotten the cruelty of this war?
We have not forgotten the cruelty of the Germans. Certainly, everyone knows of the Holocaust. Everyone knows of what happened there and how bad it was. But it has been a strange thing to see how little understanding there is of how bad everything was on the Asian side of this war. The Pacific War, it was an absolutely monstrous war, and the Japanese killed millions and millions of people, and they were just terrible to prisoners of war. And to give you a statistic to back that up, if you fell into the hands of the Germans as a prisoner of war, your chances of dying were only 1%. If you were an American that fell into the hands of the Japanese, your chances of dying were more than 37%.
There was one particular person that entered into Louis Zamperini's life. His nickname given to him, I believe, by the prisoners was the Bird, and he becomes an amazing plot line in this story. How did you first hear about the Bird, and how long did it take for you to really get an understanding of this life?
The Bird, I don't know if I still have come to an understanding of him, because true evil is such a mysterious thing. But this was a man who became Louis, essentially his guard, at prison camp and became completely obsessed with torturing him physically and emotionally. And Louis was in his hands for much of the time that he was a prisoner of war, right to the end of the war. And this was a very, very handsome, very wealthy young man who was, at least at the time that he was a guard, completely deranged. And he ended up on MacArthur's 40 most wanted list among war criminals in the Pacific War. And he was completely obsessed with Louis specifically. He was obsessed with officers because he had been humiliated and had not become an officer himself. And he was obsessed with people who were prominent in civilian life, and Louis was this famous Olympian. And he was obsessed with anybody who defied him. And Louis was an instinctively defiant man. And it was just a perfect storm, as they say. He just, once those two met, it was going to be a battle of wills for the rest of the war.
And the terror of the daily, constant interchange of brutality between this officer called the Bird and Louis Zamperini, it's so disheartening. And then it appears that as you're writing the story that maybe there's going to be a break or maybe there's a resolution, but this madman just keeps coming back and back and back into the story.
It's kind of hard to believe how bad it got for Louis, and I am so impressed with his ability to survive that physically and emotionally. He remained blazingly defiant against this man and did survive him emotionally. He did come home from the war a real mess, and it took a lot to put him back together again. Most of the reason I think he was so messed up after the war was the Bird.
I have to tell you, as I was reading, it felt like summer vacation times 10 for me as a reader, because it was like, oh my God, they're alive, they're going to get home. And I began, and the sudden terror began to slowly ebb away from the book, and I began to think it's going to be okay, these guys are going to be okay. But you didn't play happy ending with us, because when they came home, as you mentioned, they were seriously messed up.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
they had seen. Now, how was it talking to Louis? I mean, was he real open to talk about how things happened for him?
Well, this was really the main reason why I wanted to write the book about him. From that very first conversation I had with him, he told me this whole story of all of this abuse he had taken, and he told it with complete equanimity. He wasn't upset. There wasn't a lot of emotion in his voice. He wasn't numb. He was just speaking normally. And I said, I'm hearing what you're telling me about how bad this was, but I don't understand. How can you not hate these people? How can you tell me these things in such a calm way? And he said, that's easy. I forgave them. And that was what made me want to write the book. I wanted to know how a man survives the unsurvivable. And one of the things I explored, I didn't want to end the book with just the war ending and them being set free, because for veterans, wars don't just end that way. For men who really have been through trauma, and for women now, there's a lot they carry out of it, and Louis is a classic example. He came home with severe post-traumatic stress disorder, as did many, many prisoners of war.
He came home deeply hurt. Now, he was a hero, and life was looking pretty good for him. He discovered a beautiful young woman whom he courted and was married. And gosh, everything looks like, you know, this is the end of a beautiful story, a beautiful movie. But this guy is haunted in the night.
Yeah. He started having nightmares actually in prison camp, and they were consistently about strangling the Bird. And it was something he kind of fantasized about while the Bird was beating him. His hands would clench into fists, and this would make the Bird angrier and just make everything go on longer. But Louis couldn't help it. He was just that defiant. And so he was having these nightmares during the war, and then he came home, and the nightmares got worse and worse. And he kept dreaming about a particular incident in which the Bird whipped him in the head with a belt buckle. And one night, he dreamt that he was strangling the Bird, and he woke up and realized that he was straddling his pregnant wife with his hands around her neck, strangling her. And fortunately, he woke up in time and didn't hurt her. But it really, really shook him. It had gotten that bad.
Now, this was accompanied by a lot of self-medication at this stage in the game for him, right?
He became an alcoholic, as did many, many prisoners of war, former prisoners of war from the Pacific War. About a quarter of them became alcoholics. Lots and lots of them drank themselves to death. I think Louis was on that path to drinking himself to death. He got to the point where he was passing out every night. He was drinking so hard to get away from flashbacks and nightmares and just his general anxiety and rage. He needed something, and he couldn't find anything to make himself feel okay. So that's why he was drinking.
And this is where I'm thinking to myself, oh, where can this story go? He survives the sea. He survives a prison camp. But now he's back, and he is in a living hell.
Yeah, the worst struggle of all for him, as for many, many prisoners of war, came after it was all over. The emotional consequences were simply terrible. And I interviewed so many of these men who had had terrible, terrible time for the rest of their lives. You know, I'm talking to them 60 years later, and they're still having nightmares. They're still hoarding food. They're digging in trash cans. They're, one man could never stay in a hotel again for his entire life because he would have these nightmares and start screaming and wake up everyone in the hotel. It was a very common consequence of being a prisoner of the Japanese.
Wow, what a powerful story, which I hope on this Memorial Day will help you be more mindful of our veterans and the costs that so many paid for the liberties and freedoms we enjoy. So on this Memorial Day, thank a veteran, thank their families. If you see someone in uniform, bless and encourage them. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Part 2 will be tomorrow, so I hope you can join me again at this time for the Tuesday edition of Mark and Friends. God's very best to you on this Memorial Day.